So let's explore this formalism a little more concretely by going back to two-dimensional spaces, going back to this spin half particle. And, well, we know first those two general equivalents. Spin half quantum states are described by a two complex dimensional Hilbert space. The operators on that space correspond to 2 by 2 complex matrices. I'm not saying anything profound here. We need only 4 such operators to make a basis if we allow ourselves arbitrary complex coefficients. And you could take whatever choice of basis you like in principle, but a particularly useful choice is the identity in the Pauli matrices, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. They're all Hermitian, of course. They're certainly linearly independent, so they define a basis. They satisfy, from the Pauli relations, trace sigma I, sigma j is 2 delta ij. The Pauli matrices themselves are traceless. The identity has trace 2, of course. So then there's a sort of symmetry among the Pauli matrices, but the identity is slightly distinguished choice. But fine, we can work with that. What can we say about a general density matrix row? Well, its trace, if we multiply it by the identity, it's just its trace, so that's 1. If I look at trace of row with one of the Pauli matrices, and take the complex conjugate, that'll give me the same thing as taking the Hermitian conjugate of the operator on the inside. That, since these are both Hermitian, that's just trace of sigma I dagger, but that's sigma I. Rho dagger, but that's rho. So just the operators the other way around. But now trace is cyclic, so I can switch the order of the operators again. And I see trace of rho sigma I is real. So rho always had trace 1 when multiplied with by the identity. And we have 3 real parameters. Trace rho sigma 1, trace rho sigma 2, trace rho sigma 3. And we can represent any density matrix row in terms of those 3 parameters. But I'll spell that out a little more on the next slide, actually. But let's also explore what we can do with that. Okay. So recapping the logic. We've got any operator A on 2 dimensions, acting on the 2-dimensional Hilbert space. I could write it as some complex linear combination, the identity and the Pauli matrices. So in particular, if A is a density matrix, I can write it that way. But now we've got quite a lot of constraints. If it's a density matrix, it's Hermitian. So this decomposition daggered has to equal the same thing. And that tells me that each of these coefficients AI and A0 has to be real. So I've already reduced 4 complex coefficients to 4 real coefficients. We also have that trace row is the identity. And since these terms are traceless, that just gives me A0 times trace the identity, 2A0. So A0 is 1/2. We've lost one of the real coefficients. We're down to 3 real coefficients. And let's call them A1, A2, A3, natural notation. What do we have then? We have rho is 1/2 times the identity, that's fixed, plus this linear combination, A dot sigma. And if you write out the Pauli matrices explicitly into its 2 by 2 matrices, this looks like this combination of the AIs. So you notice you get this and its complex conjugate, and then terms involving 1 plus or minus A3 here. What can we do with that? Well, another thing that we know about rho is that it's positive semi-definite. So the eigenvalues of this operator have got to be non-negative. So we could work out those eigenvalues, and that's a little bit of algebra, and they actually take a rather simple form. 1/2 1 plus or minus the modulus of the vector A. So if they're both non-negative, well, I guess it's the one with the minus sign we have to worry about. We have mod A less than or equal to 1. So rho is now given by, well, once 4, but it's now 3 real parameters satisfying this constraint, mod A less than or equal to 1. What else? Well, suppose, of course, it doesn't have to be pure, but suppose the density matrix we're interested in is pure. Then we have trace rho squared. It's the same thing as trace rho, because rho squared is the same thing as rho, equals 1. So we could feed that into our general expression. Trace rho squared, well, what's that? It's rho is a half 1 plus a dot sigma, so it's this expression. And that gives a half 1 plus mod a squared. So for rho to be pure, well, that expression's got to equal 1, and that can only work if mod a equals 1. So we have a further constraint in the case of pure density matrices. Effectively, we've now got two real parameters rather than three. What else can we notice? Well, certainly everything about this calculus is linear. If I take two density matrices, rho 1 and rho 2, and write them like so with vectors a1 and a2, and I take a convex combination, or even a general linear combination, I just need to take the appropriate convex combination of a1 and a2 to write t rho 1, that's what meant t rho 2, in this new form. Okay, so to sum up, we've got a linear representation of density matrices, linear in the sense that it behaves naturally under addition and multiplication by real scalars. It maps our density matrices onto three-dimensional real vectors, and it maps the pure density matrices onto three-dimensional real vectors of length 1, in other words, onto the surface of a sphere in three dimensions. And this is our familiar friend, the Bloch sphere. This thing A is a Bloch vector, and it's giving us a geometric representation of rho. And we've already seen that for pure states rho. We knew that we could map pure states in two complex dimensions onto the surface of the Bloch sphere. But now we have this more general possibility. If rho is not pure, but mod A is less than 1. And so we have a representation of mixed states lying within the sphere. Let me bring that up. Okay. So if we think of a general state, rho, well, if you're thinking of Cartesian coordinates x, y, z, then we need to use the notation sigma x, sigma y, sigma z. So the coordinates x, y, z on this map are just given by trace of rho, sigma x, trace rho, sigma y, trace rho, sigma z. These three things define the vector. A, mod a equals 1 corresponds to states on the boundary of the sphere. Those are the pure states. Modulus a less than 1 corresponds to states somewhere in the interior of the sphere. And you notice, I guess there's a distinguished point at the center of the sphere, corresponding to a equals 0, which is the uniformly mixed state in two dimensions. It's just half times the identity operator. And obviously, it's completely rotationally symmetric. It looks exactly the same in any basis. So that's it's a geometrically pretty way of representing density matrices in 2D. It's also quite a calculationally powerful one. And often, because it works so nicely, often if we want to work in higher dimensions, it's quite helpful to think of taking our dimension D to be some power of 2 and representing our states as n qubits, and then using what's implied by this representation. We'll see a sort of toy example of that a bit later. Any questions on that? So let me just stress, everything works naturally in this picture. If you've got rho 1 and rho 2 sitting somewhere like that, if you want to look at convex combinations, they're the states that lie on the line between rho 1 and rho 2. If you want to understand what a uniform mixture, an equal mixture of the up y and down y state is, well, you need to join the line between them. go halfway along, since it's an equal mixture, and you find it's uniformly mixed state. And you notice that that's a mixture, not just then an equal mixture, not just of up y and down y, and up there z and down z, and of up x and down x, but of any pair of orthogonal states. And that's another way of representing what's a familiar fact. If you take two orthogonal states, you can decompose the identity in terms of the sum of the projections onto both of them. Okay, well, before moving beyond proper mixed states, I wanted to add a slide commenting a little bit on the question that we've maybe also touched on a little bit this morning. Is there something objectively real about proper mixed states? Or do they always arise from this sort of game in which a colleague is hiding information from us, or a piece of apparatus is malfunctioning, or we don't have the details, but in principle, somewhere out there in the guts of the apparatus, the details are there. Certainly, as presented so far, proper mixed states are a reflection of our subjective ignorance, stuff we don't know about some objective facts, something out there, the colleague's memory or the details of the machine. Then, I think we could get through life perfectly well, as far as we know at the moment, assuming that that's all there is to say about proper mixed states. They are always representing subjective ignorance of objective facts. I don't think we know for sure whether there's any situation in which a proper mixed state is the ultimate objective representation of reality. But it's worth mentioning that it's a logically perfectly coherent possibility. We have a density matrix evolution norm, we have a measurement postulate for proper mixed states that's self-contained. All you need is rho and h, the Hamiltonian, and the details of the measurement, of course, to apply those postulates. You don't need a decomposition of rho. It's self-contained and it's consistent. So logically, in principle, you could postulate for any system, but it simply starts in an initially mixed state, and that's all there is that can be said about it. In particular, you could postulate that about the universe. You could devise a cosmological theory in which the initial state is some proper mixed state, presumably, it depends a bit on the details of the measurements, it will carry on staying mixed forever. Follow this evolution, for instance. But I don't think we know for sure whether nature's used this possibility. And I think I'll just finish the slide and then. I think actually, as we'll see a little more clearly after I've discussed the alternative possibility of improper mixed states, it would really be quite hard to tell for sure whether nature had used that possibility, because it's very hard to think of a way in which you could tell for sure that a mixed state is proper or improper. Maybe there's entanglement with some degrees of freedom we haven't understood. Question?
So could you remind me what a proper and improper, like what the distinction
mixed
is?
Mixed right. Let me just fix this. So, so really, I'm looking ahead whenever I talk about improper mixed states. All we've discussed so far are proper mixed states. You find the it's back on the previous. Okay, so this is how we started this discussion. We have a list of states and a list of probabilities, something like that. List of states and list of probabilities prepared for us, for instance, by a secretive colleague. The proper mixed state was the thing rho equals was this operator defined from that list of probabilities and states. I said when I introduced the term proper that it's distinguished from improper mixed states. It is. I haven't yet defined what an improper mixed state is. We're coming to that next. So let me hold that part of the answer until we get to it. Should I elaborate further, or did you just want that terminology?
That's good.
So I guess the question I've just been touching on is whether you could sort of imagine that it's as though the initial state of the universe were prepared by a colleague who's thrown away the data, without actually believing in the colleague.
Yeah, I have a question to you that may stay mixed forever. I mean, after a measurement, our rho density matrix changes to a pure state, or is there a possibility that if we, a measurement of the whole system, so with a complete set of operators, so that you are able to find the correct ray in your Hilbert space, then the density matrix should describe a pure state.
Two things. First, I did make a caveat about measurement, so it depends on the details of the measurement, whether it stays mixed or becomes pure. I don't agree that generally it must become pure after a measurement. I agree it could, depending on the details. So let's try a couple of examples.
Yeah,
Sorry, are you with me, or are you? Did you want to add anything further, or should I just say?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's take a very simple example. Rho is a third, 1, 1, plus 2, 2, plus 3, 3. So we start out with a big state. We could measure this in the 1, 2, 3 basis. In other words, by the projectors 1, 1, 2, 2. 3, 3. If we do that, and let's say we get the outcome corresponding to 1, 1, then what you say is absolutely correct. Rho after that measurement with that outcome will be a pure state, it'll be 1, 1. So that gives post-measurement. So you're absolutely right to stress that it's possible for a measurement to transform an initially proper mixed state into a pure state. On the other hand, if I take a general measurement, so for instance, project onto 1 plus 2 plus 3 and a couple of other linear combinations, let's just assume that it's this one, so that's the normalization. And that this, and then we get outcome corresponding to that. Then I have to apply my general rule, but actually there's a symmetry here, so we're going to find rho prime post measurement is, I believe, the same as it was
So it doesn't become pure because you project in a subspace of the Hilbert space, which is not a ray, which is two-dimensional, for example. That's the reason that it doesn't become pure. Your measurement observables are not a complete set.
You're ahead of me. You're ahead of me. Yes. So if we have a... and this is not a good
example.
So if we have a projection, we have a measurement, and the outcome corresponds to a one-dimensional projection, then it must necessarily be a pure state.
Yeah, okay. And otherwise, your observable set wouldn't be complete. So you're not able to determine the precise ray. Okay, yeah.
Thank you very much for stressing that. If we measure... maybe not. Maybe here. Even better. Should I see on the screen? So, indeed, if we take any initially mixed state and we measure with a complete set of 1D projectors, so the outcome has to correspond to a one-dimensional projector. For instance, this one. Then the post-measurement state is going to be given by our general expression, Qj rho Qj. But if you look at that, that's really just, look at the numerator, that's Qj rho Qj is Qj Qj some Pi Psi I Qj. That last one is readable. And the point is, I mean, we just have numbers. Yeah. The only bra and ket operators are this one and this one. So this thing is proportional to the one-dimensional projector onto QJ. And it's got to be normalized, so we don't really even need to work out the concept of proportionality, because we know we're going to divide by it in the denominator. People happy? Here you go. Okay, so now we need to move forward from single systems that could have been prepared in a variety of ways to composite systems. And we're going to be very interested. We're going to look in from quite a variety of different perspectives and with quite a variety of different applications in mind. In joint systems S that are built out of two or more separately identifiable identifiable subsystems. S is S1 plus S2. Exactly how that separation works is going to depend on the details. They might be physically separated. For instance, we may be interested in the case where they're space-like separated in Minkowski space and we want to address them separately. But they might occupy the same region. Maybe they're different types of particle. Maybe they're the same. At any rate, we have some cleavage that is clear to us, some way of splitting S into two subsystems. And we know from quantum theory that we can describe the space of states of the big system H, S as the tensor product of H1, tensor H2, the spaces of states of the subsystems. And so, of course, the dimension of H is the product of the dimensions, and we have a basis for each of the subfactors, the E's and the S. We can certainly find a natural basis for the product state, for the product space H in terms of products of the orthonormal bases of the subfactors. We can find more general bases as well, but this is often a convenient one. So if I take a general state psi and h, I can write it as a linear combination of these basis vectors. Let's start with a simple case, and a rather special case, the product states. So it's certainly possible that psi could have this form, psi is psi 1 tensor psi 2. And indeed, we've already got examples here, the products of the basis vectors. Obviously, I can generalize that, take a general linear combination of those, tensor with a general linear combination of those. That's still a product state. Is it obvious to you that almost every state isn't in this form? Can anybody give me an argument for that?
No.
Yep.
For condition that it's some equation on coefficients, and so it has less dimensions than.
Okay. Yeah. We can basically just count parameters. Look at the states of this form. How many complex parameters are involved there? Well, there's really. Let's call these dimensions M1 and M2. Since we're really interested in rays, there's M1 minus 1 complex parameters freedom here, and M2 minus 1 complex parameters freedom there. And so that total freedom would be M1 minus 1 plus M2 minus 1. Complex parameters, that will characterize a general product state. On the other hand, the same argument that gave us those numbers, M1 minus 1 and M2 minus 1, tells us that a general state is parameterized by dimension of H minus 1. By M1 times M2 minus 1 parameters. And for any non-trivial case, if M1 and M2 are greater than or equal to 2, this number is larger than this one. And so we're talking about a multi-dimensional manifold and a submanifold of strictly smaller dimension. So if somebody gives you a random state in this space, it's almost certainly not a product state. We're interested in the product states, but we're going to have to deal with the others as well. And in fact, generically, we have to deal with the others. Just to clarify any notational worries, I'm sometimes going to drop the tensor product, so I'll just write states like this. And we're going to be working with density matrices, and it's always, one's never sure whether to reverse the order of everything or not, but my convention is not. So if we're working with a density matrix on the product space H1 tensor H2, that H1 state will be on the left, and so will that one, and that H2 state will be after it, and so will that one. So what can we do if we're lucky enough to have a product state? Well, quantum theory tells us that if we're thinking of measuring an observable A on S1, it's the same thing as measuring the observable A tensor the identity on the larger space. And if the state's in a product state, so we have psi is psi 1 tensor psi 2, the expectation value of A, well, using this, is just this, and it splits trivially into two factors, one of which is just the normalization of psi 2. So it's exactly the same calculation as if we were just working with S1 alone, we didn't even know about S2, and working out the expectation value of A on S1. So for this calculation, at least, we can just take S1 and S2 as separate systems with individual states psi1 and psi2, and we'll get the right answers. More generally, we want to think under what circumstances might we expect the joint state to be a product state, and why might we expect it to stay in a product state if it starts that way? And we need the idea of an isolated pair of systems. So what do I mean by that? S1 and S2 are isolated. If there's no interaction between them, there's no interaction term in the joint Hamiltonian, we can decompose the total Hamiltonian as a self-Hamiltonian for S1 and a self-Hamiltonian for S2, and that's it. So the unitary evolution operator is just the product of these two operators, and we could write it as a tensor product of U1 of t, U2 of t, evolution for S1 and S2. Which means if we start out in a product state, like so, times zero, and we apply the unitary evolution, like so, we continue to be in a product state, different product state, but now psi1 of t tends to psi2 of t, where these are just the unitarily evolved psi's. And if we measure either of the subsystems, a similar observation applies. So, for instance, if I carry out a measurement on S1, that corresponds to measuring corresponding projector, so P tensor I on the joint thing. This state, let's say, is the outcome. Well, I can write this as a product. As though I carry out a measurement just on S1 and S2 were irrelevant, P psi1 normalized tensor psi2. I changed the state of S1. I've left the state of S2 alone. I've kept the whole thing still a product state. So this, this may seem a little bit pedantic, almost to tautologists, but it's I think useful to go through it to contrast with what's to follow. But in the situation where we have a product state, we've verified that these individual states, psi of t, characterize all there is to say about the system, all the physics we can. Evolutions, yes. Measurements, yes. That's it. They are the states of S1 and S2 in the same, exactly the same sense as their product is the state of S. And it's really just a matter of arbitrariness, a matter of convention, whether you choose to work with S1 alone, S2 alone, or consider S1 and S2 as a joint system. It's a matter of convention. Okay. However, we're agreed, that's a very special case. Almost all the quantum states of S1 and S2 aren't product states. Even if we have isolated systems, which maybe we think we can arrange, it may be rather harder to guarantee that they and their components were always isolated in the past. They might have some common source in the experiment, or the chemicals that made them were created in the same star, or going back to the Big Bang. There's some common source. So we need to be able to talk about the physics of a joint system, not in a product state. And maybe the first thing to do is to find a name for these things. We're going to call them entangled. Any state psi that is not a product state is an entangled state. It's a simple name, and it goes back to an article by Schrödinger in 1935. It's something that Schrödinger instantly realized had a profound significance. Just to quote the last sentence of the first paragraph here. I would not call that, in other words, entanglement, one characteristic, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces its entire departure from classical lines of thought. By the interaction, the two representatives, the quantum states, have become entangled. It does sharply distinguish quantum theory from classical physics. We can't describe the state of the joint system by taking it apart, looking at each part separately, and describing their states. That's classical reductionism. That's how physics worked up to quantum mechanics. It no longer works. Okay, so we know what an entangled state is. How do we tell whether we've got one or not? We've already mentioned one possibility. You could try and work out explicitly whether or not it can be written as a product. Here's your general state. You know what the AIJs are. Can you write it in this form? Well, that gives you a set of equations or the coefficients. It's really asking you, is there a solution to these equations in the complex variables AI, BJ? And in principle, you can plow through the algebra and check whether there is or there isn't. A somewhat slicker way, which it's also illuminating in its own right, is to look at the density matrix and then work with the partial traces. And this I think I need to say rather more about. But is everybody happy with the first way of doing things? If I wrote down the state, would everybody be able to tell me whether it's entangled or not? Zero, zero, plus zero, one. It's one, one. Any votes for product? Any votes for entangled? Any votes at all? It's not normalized, I admit, so let me.
Entangled?
Getting some votes for entangled. Right, so who says entangled now? Okay. Any votes for product? The rest are abstaining. Okay. Sure. So we have to see that. Well, can we write this?
Yeah.
that, what would that tell us? There must be a quick way to do this. Let's see. It tells us that B times C equals zero, because there's no one zero state here. But B times D equals, there. So B times D equals 1, and A times C equals 1, and A times D equals 1. Okay, and that's a contradiction, because if I take equations 2 and 3 and multiply them together, I get BDAC equals 1. And if I divide by equation 4, I can throw away the AD, so I get BC equals 1. But equation 1 says BC equals 0. Okay. So if we're out of other ideas, and we have enough time, we can certainly work it out one way or the other. What I want to do, though, is to think more abstractly about the tensor product structure and what it gives us. So I want to generalize the idea of a trace over the full Hilbert space to the trace over one factor in a two-factor Hilbert space, where H is H1, tensor H2. And I want to look at things like this, where we're tracing over H1. And just as formally, this is going to look exactly the same as the familiar trace operation. So just as for space H, trace over H of an operator A, we could write as the sum over I, EI, A, EI for any basis of any orthogonal basis, orthonormal basis. I'm going to use exactly that expression in defining trace over H1. So this is a sum of the inner product with states of the form EI, EI, where these define an orthonormal basis of H1. So you notice in this expression, I have something new. I have something that our notation hasn't really allowed us to do before. I have the inner product of a state in H1 tensor H2 with a state in H1. To build a partial trace, I need partial inner products. And these are inner products of things from different spaces. They can't define numbers as our normal inner products do. But they define bra and ket states in H2. So for instance, it's really a matter of just getting comfortable with the notation here. This thing lives in H1 tensor H2. This thing lives in H1, and so it's taking away the H1 component from it. Sorry, so this was in the psi is in H1 tensor H2. The EI is in H1, and so it's taking out the H1-ness and leaving us with a bra in H2. Similarly, if I work over H2, I end up with states that are bras and kets in H1, and so the partial trace is going to give me an operator on H1. One way of defining this is to take some complete basis, define all these operations on each of the elements of the basis, and then just extend them by linearity to everything. So we can think of the partial inner product as a natural sesquilinear map, in other words, antilinear in the first part, and linear in the second. It takes a state in H1, that's the first one. It takes a state in H1, tensor H2. And it gives this thing, which itself is a state in H2. How does that work for basis vectors? Well, it works in a way that looks quite natural. If I think of this thing as corresponding to phi, this is the state in H1. And this thing is corresponding to psi, so this is an H1 tensor H2. Then the basis vector EI acts on, so to speak, the ket EJ, and I get a delta IJ, and leaves me with that delta IJ times the basis vector FK. And once I define this for these basis elements, I can just define it for a general state just by writing the state as a linear combination. So here's my general state phi. And here's my general state psi in H1 tensor H2. That's another linear combination of product basis elements. And I just need to remember that it's antilinear so that I get a complex conjugate here. And it's linear, so these just stay unconjugated. The elementary, the basis elements give me delta ij fk, and I just need to sum over all of them with the relevant coefficients to get the expression for the, you know, the partial inner product phi with psi. Okay. Well, just as in the case of trace, you often start by writing down a definition for the trace operation in terms of a particular basis. Even if you're working with matrices, you tend to say, well, it's the trace is the sum of the diagonal elements. And essentially there, you're picking out the basis in which you've chosen to represent the matrix. Having done that, you've got to verify that your definitions are actually basis independent. And it goes through for the same, for these definitions, for essentially the same reasons it does for trace. You can shift from one basis to another by unitary operations, allow for that, and see that all the factors corresponding to the unitary maps drop out. So that was the partial inner product. And then the partial trace, the partial inner product, remember, takes a state in H1 and a state in H1 tensor H2 gives a state in H2. Partial trace is going to take an operator, for example, a density matrix, on H1 tensor H2, and give me an operator on H1. And again, maybe the simplest way to get up and running is to define this for a basis of operators. So these operators defined by the product basis elements form a basis. Give it a natural action. So here what we're doing is tracing over H2. In other words, we're going to pull this FJ2 around here and inner product it with this FJ1. And that will give us a delta J1, J2. And we're going to leave alone the things that live in H1. So they survive there. There's the factor from F. And having defined that for this basis of the operators, we could take a general operator, write it as a linear combination, and use linearity to give a general definition. Equivalently, we can just use the definition that's directly inspired by the ordinary trace. Trace over H2 of the operator A is just given by summing over its expectation values in the elements of any orthonormal basis of H2. Are they the same thing? Well, to check that, you just need to check that they give the same answer for a complete basis, since they're both linear expressions. And they do, so they are. Does it matter which basis we choose? It doesn't. Again, you need to check this. Again, it's exactly the same calculation as the familiar one from the ordinary trace, and it's enough to check it for basis operators. Okay. So we've got a way, given a joint system S1 plus S2, given its Hilbert space H1 tensor H2, we've got a way of extracting something that looks as though it's associated just with one of the subsystems, S1 or S2. In this case, I've traced over H1, I've traced over the degrees of freedom corresponding to S1. I've got a thing called thing rho 2. It's certainly an operator on H2. What more can we say about it? It's easy to see that it's self-adjoint. Really, you just need to see that this thing's self-adjoint and everything else follows. It's also easy to see that if we now trace over the second Hilbert space, H2, well, that's equivalent to basically taking both traces at once. Trace H2 of this thing that was already a partial trace, H1, psi psi. It's just the same thing as taking the trace over the whole Hilbert space of psi psi, S1. So rho 2 is normalized. And if I take a general state phi in H2, so we need to check positive semi-definiteness. What's the expectation value of rho 2 in phi? Well, I can write it like this, and then I can write out the explicit definition of partial trace, and I get a sum of non-negative terms. So indeed, rho 2 is positive semi-definite. And you remember, those are the only three things we needed to check that we had a density matrix. Self-adjointness, normalization, positive semi-definiteness. So we found a way of constructing a density matrix associated with each subsystem, S1 and S2, by this algebraic operation of partial tracing. And if we go back to the case that we're probably most comfortable with, the case of product states, everything we've done gives us familiar answers. So take psi to be a product state, psi 1 tends to psi 2. Rho 2, this density matrix associated to S2, given by the partial trace over H1, psi psi. Partial trace over H1 of this, just writing out psi explicitly. Well, I just need to bring together those two factors. And the traces apply to these are going to be left alone. So that's just psi 1 times this, that's just 1. So that's psi 2. In other words, rho 2 is a pure density matrix, and it's the pure density matrix corresponding to what we know is the state describing psi 2. And similarly, rho 1 is the state is the density matrix corresponding to the pure state we know describes psi 1. And it works the other way around as well. If we know that we have a pure density matrix rho 2 given by the partial trace over H1, then we can check that the full state psi indeed has to be some product state. These coefficients just drop out of the algebra. Okay, so we have a product state if and only if the two partial trace operations give us two density matrices corresponding pure states. So here's another very nice thing about the partial trace operation. Take a completely general state psi in the tensor product space, and take a look at its partial traces, rho 1 and rho 2, for the two factors. Those are both density matrices, so we can diagonalize them. They'll have real eigenvalues and orthogonal eigenvectors. Let's call them lambda I EI for the first, mu I FI for the second. And you do it, and you should try this for a simple example. You do it, you work these out, and you see, hey presto, they're actually the same. The eigenvectors, sorry, the eigenvalues, that is, are the same list. And with a little more algebra, you see also that you could take the original state psi and write it not as a double sum, which we already knew how to do, but a single sum of members of an appropriate product basis. The appropriate product basis being given by these eigenvectors and these eigenvectors. And you'll find that you can write psi as a sum of eigenvalue times eigenvector state test with eigenvector state. And the sum runs over a size no bigger than the smaller of the two Hilbert spaces. And this result goes back more than 100 years. It was noticed by somebody called Schmidt. What it's telling us is that up to sort of enhancement by lots of zeros, depending on the size of the spaces, these are essentially the same matrix. And I'm not going to prove it for you now. We will either set it as a tutorial example for you to verify it, or give you a handout to go through the algebra, because it's probably a little more illuminating to work through outside class than during. But let's just say, stress for now, once the result's stated, it's more or less, it's one of these things that once you know what you're trying to prove, it's more or less directly provable from the statement. So notice also, this has given us a very direct algorithm for telling whether a state's entangled or not. All you need to do is to work out one of these things, it doesn't really matter which one, and look at the list of eigenvalues. If there's more than one eigenvalue, then your state is represented by a sum with more than one element of this form, and that isn't a product state. There's no way of writing that as a product. Ergo, it's entangled. So unless there's a unique eigenvalue, it's an entangled state. And it tells you a little more than that. And you could flesh this out. You could make this more precise. But at least intuitively, it gives some qualitative idea of how entangled a state is or isn't. If you've got one very large eigenvalue and then lots of small ones, okay, it's not a product state, but it's not that far away from a product state. It's not very entangled. If you've got lots of distinct eigenvalues that are pretty much the same, it's very far away from being a product state. It's, so to speak, very entangled. We're seeing at least a hint of how you could build up a quantitative measure of entanglement, a quantitative theory of entanglement. Okay. What more are partial traces good for? Well, we've already used that. If we're interested in measurements on S1, we could equivalently think of them as extended measurements on S1 plus S2. That holds true whether we're talking about product states or entangled states. So let's take a general state psi in the joint space. What's the expectation value of our observable A that's on S1 of psi? Well, it's the expectation value of A tends to the identity with psi around it. What can I do here? I can certainly introduce the decomposition of the identity into projections onto orthogonal eigenstates, Fj, there. So let me do that. I can rewrite this expression as a trace. So all I've done here is pull this psi, put this psi around to the back there. I've written this as a trace, so the trace will wrap psi back like that. Okay, so I can You're free to do that. And then you notice that this expression involves nothing that's acting on H2. It's going to be, if I take a partial trace over H2, this expression is not going to feature at all. On the other hand, this expression is exactly the partial trace over H2. So I could write this trace over H2 and tensor H2 separately, the trace over H1 and the trace over H2, and notice that the A doesn't feature inside here because it's acting trivially. I have trace over H1A, partial trace of psi. And here's the payoff. This expectation value is given by a trace now over just H1 of the operator we're interested in, A, times rho 1, the density matrix that we constructed from psi by taking the partial trace over H2. So we could calculate the expectation value of a measurement on S1, and so also the probability of any outcome for measurement, using only rho 1. This formula now doesn't involve psi directly. That's intriguing. That suggests that we've got a way of breaking up general results on the joint system into results about subsystems that are associated with the density matrices we can construct from those subsystems. Notice also, we've seen this expression before in a different context, but a related context. This is exactly the expression that we obtained when we were trying to work out how to deal with proper mixed state density matrices and measurements of observables or measurements in general on proper mixed states. So that's it's sort of clear where this is likely to be leading. That's very suggestive. It's suggesting that we might be able to treat this operator rho 1 in the same sort of way as we successfully treated the density matrix, the density matrices associated with proper mixed states. Can we verify that it evolves in exactly the same way as a proper mixed state density matrix, for example, and more generally that it encodes all the physics of S1, encodes all the information we could obtain about S1. Clearly, we could just plow through the algebra, but it's sort of immediately clear that's not going to work if S1 and S2 are interacting. The state of S2 is going to be affecting S1 continually, and so we're not going to be able to work solely with anything, any density matrix defined for S1, and write an evolution law for it that doesn't involve S2. Okay, so let's just accept that, but at least for the moment. But focus on the case where it still might work, the case where S1 and S2 are isolated. So if they're isolated, remember, their evolution law factorizes, like so. And if we take the partial trace of the density matrix for the full system at time t, well, let's give them a trace over H2. And again, these factors are going to be left alone. They're acting on H1. I could wrap this e to the I H2t around, and it will cancel with e to the minus I H2t. And I could pull, since they act on the other factor, I could pull these outside the partial trace operation. I have e to the minus I H1t over H bar. This partial trace, e to the IH1t over h bar. In other words, I do indeed have a closed form evolution law for rho 1. And it's exactly, again, not just do I have an evolution law, but it's exactly the same as the evolution law that we got for proper mixed states. So that looks very promising. It looks as though we have a project going here in which we can analyze the physics of subsystem 1 in terms of its reduced density matrix. But But we haven't finished. Even in the case of proper mixed states, we saw it was a little, we needed a little more thought to deal with what happens when we carry out measurements. And here we have something slightly new to worry about in that context. We have to worry about measurements on system one, certainly. That's the system we're actually dealing with. But we also have to worry about the possibility that S2 is, that somebody carried out a measurement on S2. Measurements are carried out on S2. At the moment, we've allowed for the possibility of S2 evolving under unitary evolution. We've assumed S1 and S2 are isolated. But it's fine for two isolated systems to exist and for us to be interested in this one. But somebody else, or maybe something in nature, effectively measuring the other one. So we certainly need to consider what happens if measurements are carried out from S2. So what does happen? Well, take a general operator B on S2. So we're really measuring the identity tensor B on the book system. Think of this as an observable. After the measurement, we're going to get some eigenvalue. And the state is going to be given by the corresponding eigenprojection. So the new joint state is going to be identity tensor PI psi normalized. Fine. So our new reduced density matrix for S1, trace over H2 of the new joint state, is going to look like this. And remember, our old density matrix looked like this. And it's not immediately clear, maybe, what to say about that, except that those two states don't immediately look equal. Now, it's true we had a situation before when we worried about measurements for proper mixed states, in which we had an equality that wasn't quite transparent. It involved some cancellations. So we could still hope that somehow this will work out, that this equals this. And why do we want them to be equal? We want them to be equal because we want to be able to talk about the physics of S1 in terms of ρ1 without having to worry that it's going to change by operations that have been carried out on S2 that we have no access to and no control over. That's what we would like. We're seeing here a query, at least, over that project. It looks as though it might be running into trouble. So we could try an example. Here's a simple example. Take this joint state psi. Normalize some of these product states. E1 tensor F1 plus E2 tensor F2. Think about the measurement of projections onto the basis for H2, PI. And suppose we get the outcome corresponding to the label I. So the post-measurement state, pre-measurement we have this, post-measurement it collapses onto one of these, EI tensor. Fi. So the reduced density matrix after the measurement is just this pure state, EI, EI. The reduced density matrix before the measurement was a mixed state given by an equal-weighted mixture of the states E1 and E2. And they're not the same. They're definitely not the same. So if we're going to make our project work, we're going to need to think about exactly where we're heading and where we should be heading. It isn't as simple as saying that we can allow arbitrary things to happen on S2, calculate the joint state, calculate the joint state and then calculate the reduced density matrix for S1 and find that nothing ever changes. On the contrary, the way we've just done this calculation, at least, suggests that measurements on one entangled system do indeed change the reduced density matrix of the other one. We just saw ρ1 prime doesn't equal ρ1. And that's true even if they're isolated. So That's interesting. I mean, we're at least getting somewhere. One might think it's possible, but before rushing to conclusions, I think it's worth going back to the case of proper mixed states that we analysed before. In that case, the density matrix that we found was able to represent all the physics of S1. Represented a subjective quantity. It represented all the information we ourselves, people sitting with S1, had about the system that we were interested in. More information was out there, as we've already been discussing quite a lot today. Our colleague knows which state they prepared. The internal state of our misfiring device would give more information about which state it actually produced. There is more information out there somewhere in the world, but we don't have it. And to define the density matrix, we had to take account of the knowledge we actually had in our possession, not the full knowledge that's available everywhere in the universe. So there's something analogous here. It is true that if we have two entangled systems and a measurement is carried out on S2, then the outcome of that measurement can in general give information that wasn't previously available about S1, or perhaps can create information that's not initially available about S1. That seems to be what our calculations have been saying, and it's true. But the analogy of proper mixed states suggests that the right thing for us to focus on is what we ourselves can learn about S1 by experiments on S1. We certainly can't assume that S2 is being left alone. Anything could be happening. We have to allow for the possibility that measurements are being carried on S2. But if we're going to follow the analogy that worked in the previous case, it's not really a matter of choice. We must assume to get somewhere interesting, we must assume, for the moment at least, that we're ignorant of the measurement outcomes for S2, whatever they are, or whatever measurements they are. At any rate, that's a calculation we can do. And it turns out to lead somewhere interesting. So we should do it. That's been a bit of a trek already. So are there questions? Are people clear where we're heading? Everybody happy? Okay, so I'm not going to overrun very much, but let's just press on just a little bit further. So the calculation we actually need to do is this one. Suppose a measurement is carried out on S2, and here are the corresponding projectors. So one of these states will be obtained. One of these states, psi I prime, given by the relevant projector applied to psi, normalized. And what are the probabilities? They're just given by this standard expression, which is straight from the projection posture. We don't know which of these states was obtained. All we know is this list and this list of probabilities. So given that, following the analogy of the proper mixed states, for us, the relevant post-measurement density matrix should be given by taking the partial trace over the proper mixture corresponding to this list of probabilities and this list of outcomes. Partial trace over H2, sum of PI, those are the probabilities, psi I prime, that's the ket corresponding to this outcome, and then the corresponding bra. More explicitly, the probability is this mod squared term here. Psi I prime is this state here, and it has a normalization factor. So there's the ket, there's the bra. We need to square the normalization factor, and we notice that it's actually the same thing as that probability. we can cancel those two terms. And that, it looks so simple in terms of algebra, but those two crosses, that cancellation, is absolutely at the heart of why quantum theory and special relativity managed to coexist peacefully. If the rules were different, if this probability was a slightly different expression, it wouldn't work, and we would have a contradiction to quantum theory and special relativity. The calculation would be telling us you can send superluminal signals by carrying out measurements on entangled systems. So it's it's important for you to be happy that you can get to this algebra, be happy with the derivation and clear about exactly why this cancellation works. It's maybe one of the key things in this whole course, in this whole discussion. Okay, anyway, cancellation is there. What have we got left to do? Trace over H2. Well, now we have another projector that we can wrap around, so instead of pi squared, we get pi. We have a sum over I pi, and it was a complete set of projectors, so that's just the identity. So this is just the trace over H2 psi psi. Rho 1 prime, a reduced density matrix for S1 after the measurement on S2 is exactly the same thing as rho 1, the reduced density matrix before the measurement. And we've got what we hoped we were going to get. We've got a situation in which we can represent the physics of S1 in terms of this thing rho 1. And as long as S1 and S2 are isolated, we don't have to worry about Hamiltonian evolutions of S2, we don't have to worry about measurements on S2, they're not going to change rho 1. This, we already verified it for Hamiltonian evolutions, and now we verified it for measurements. And just to summarize, remember our assumption was isolation, we have a general entangled initial state. We define the reduced density matrix in terms of the partial trace. We update it whenever we do things to S1 and get measurement outcomes, but we don't do that for S2. We find we have a closed form evolution law for S1 and for the reduced density matrix. We have a closed form measurement postulate, again, for measurements on S1. And both of those are exactly the same as the ones we got for proper mixed states. And we find that S2 is irrelevant to these calculations in the sense that as it's unchanged by evolution, unitary evolution of S2, that's isolated from S1, and it's unchanged by measurements given our ignorance of the outcome of those measurements. That's probably a good place to stop. Are there questions?
Is this the full statement of the no-signaling theorem, or is there?
Essentially, yes. I mean, we could go on to generalize our account of measurements and then go through the no-signaling for generalized measurements. But essentially, yes, it's in here. So I realize I've thrown quite a lot of algebra at you this afternoon. You probably want to go away and work through some of it, but it's algebra with a purpose. Any other questions for the moment? Okay, so let's leave it there and continue tomorrow.